There is a halfway mark between the known and unknown. A middle ground or chamber where divine wisdom and truth reside. In this middle chamber, we will explore and expose the ruling paradigms of social engineering, mind control, government conspiracies, and cover-ups. Join us as we navigate the territories and boundaries of natural law and the ancient principles of the sacred feminine and divine masculine. Examine and consider alternative energy systems, holistic healing arts, and wild soulful living to train our awareness in a most novel and abstract manner to view reality from an entirely new perspective. Welcome to the Middle Chamber.
All right, welcome once again, everyone, to another episode of the Middle Chamber. Another great show lined up for you here, everyone. I am Freighter X, and I'll be talking with Master Magical Adept E.A. Coetting about his latest work, The Anthology of Sorcery, Volume 1, which can be found over at his website, becomealivinggod.com. Check out all that website for what it might have to offer you in the way of postmodern magical needs. As always, extra special thanks to MaterX for allowing me the freedom and quiet to have this conversation by taking our children off on their own adventure for now. So thanks again. Follow the latest from the Middle Chamber on our Facebook page, which is FreighterX first name, MaterX last name. Our blogs are freighterx.blogspot.com and materx369.blogspot.com. This show's site is Middle Chamber FX, the letters fx.wordpress.com. You can follow us also on Twitter at TMC369, at TMC369. And for the record, we are asking anyone who can help to support our big plan this summer to travel out west. We have an opportunity to tour several bookstores along the west coast from San Diego to L.A. to San Francisco, Portland, Seattle. And we're going to complete the journey in Olympia, Washington at the Sync Summit from August 2nd to August 9th. This whole journey is next month, but it's going to take a lot of startup funds to pay for media, merchandise we need to sell out there when we're going to all these spots, and extra expenses for travel. So if you can, now is the time to help, everybody. Please, if you can, give to our PayPal account under MaterX's email, which is MaterX369, the numbers 369, at gmail.com. MaterX369 at gmail.com. Thank you for any help you can give us. And things are really tight around here, for real. So, you know, we're both working overtime to make everything happen, and we're just asking folks who can to help us out. Now, in just a moment, we're going to welcome our extra special guest to this episode's chat. And as usual, the chat is at middlechamberchat.chatango.com. So if it's Saturday night, 9 p.m. right now, you should go over there and join us in the chat room while we review this podcast together and field any questions and comments from other listeners who are there listening. Special thanks to our last guest, Dr. Colin Ross, discussing his research into CIA mind control programs, having reviewed 15,000 declassified documents from the CIA's MK Ultra program. Check out that show in two parts at the usual spots on the web, link over at Sync Book Radio Network, which is thesyncbook.com. And we're also on Stitcher Radio Network. Anyone wants to go over there, keyword search is the Middle Chamber. That's about it for the context. Now, the course of our discourse travels down several narrative threads. Primary among them is the voyage of discovery, uncovering and disclosing the methods of bondage and control we recognize at the root and foundation of human culture, especially in the last dozen millennia or so. But the other pillar, the other focus, the other strand or thread of this discourse are ways of liberation, insight into methods, tools and skillful devices or vehicles to traverse the maze that is this mortal coil as we so often perceive it. Now, our guest for this episode is the veritable tip of the spear with regards to the significant wave of postmodern magical empowerment, a movement that we're finding in today's new thought arena or sphere of influence, so to speak. And he has produced yet another amazing tome in an ever-expanding catalog of powerful grimoires, exploring and chronicling the darkness, really, that encompasses the so-called left-handed path to magic, the left-hand path. His Anthology of Sorcery, Volume 1, has already sold out of its first printing, I believe, while preparing to release the Volume 2. It's very exciting, indeed, and I can report that our last conversation here in the middle chamber with EA Coetting is to date right now the highest rated podcast for listens and downloads on every single platform offering the middle chamber out there on the internet. And it really is no surprise, actually, because not only is the subject matter fascinating, but EA really delivers his material and life's work with an exceptional and interesting flair. So let's welcome our guest, E.A. Coetting. Welcome back to the Middle Chamber. How are you, Eric?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Thank you for that the generous introduction, for sure. The anthology was a massive success, and it is sold out already. That must have set some record for occult publishing. We sold out. I think it was 3 weeks. We sold out. Every last copy that we had printed. So, we're on to our. We're already gathering the list of people that we're inviting on to the second edition of the Anthology of Sorcery. With everything that we're seeing, this is going to blow it out of the water as well. So, look forward to keeping it rolling on and rolling forward.
Excellent. I can really believe that you're going to have continued success because you've really brought together an amazing cadre of writers and researchers. I was really impressed, and I've been really looking forward to this talk because, I'm really excited. Now, I haven't completed the book, I'll be honest, but I'm about halfway through, and I'm looking forward to the completion of it. To be honest with you, I'm finishing my own book right now, so I'm kind of focused on that. I'm at the very last chapter, the last few pages before I basically turn this thing over to the publishers for editing and my own release. So it's how exciting that can be and how focused you get on that. Everything else kind of takes a little bit of a back seat and a back burner.
Absolutely, writing and then not only writing but then putting that into a usable format for the readers is it's a task for sure.
Yeah, that has been a great challenge for me. And for yourself, the challenge has been, which you've impressively met, I would say, is to offer what you've gathered as a practical system, as a way for people, like I was alluding to in the beginning of this chat here, just the idea that there are skillful means, there are ways of liberation that are available that do resonate. And like you pointed out in this chapter that I'd like to discuss today, that what you've pointed out is that there is a certain resonant frequency that has been reached, a pitch, if you will. And before we jump into it, like I said, I haven't finished the whole book, but I wanted to give some honorable mention to the other works that were a part of this anthology that I have looked at. Of course, Lon Milo Duquette, friend of the show, his chapter, which is a pretty chilling description of a real exorcism that's pretty impressive. As usual, he delivers it in his signature style that's it's an amusing narrative of a terrifying incident, in many ways.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, I was a bit surprised that he was able to throw his hat, you know, his amazing hat that only he can wear with that kind of flair. He was able to throw that into the ring on a subject of black magic and not come across as anything other than just amazing. I mean, Lon Milo's really an amazing individual, and so when Timothy, my partner at Become a Living God, the co-founder of the whole project, he emailed me and he says, hey, so we've got Lon Milo contributing to this. And I thought, oh crap, what is what's he going to have to say about this subject? And it really, his article blew me away, and what they all really did. I mean, it was really just a concatenation of I mean, really, it seems almost on a dharmic level where some of the most brilliant minds in occultism were able to come together and to put this together. And you know, we didn't even throw any kind of really topic out there. We just said, hey, just write something about black magic. What's interesting is looking at the anthology as a whole, it flows, that each article flows into the next. There was definitely an invisible consciousness that seemed to be guiding the entire thing, for sure.
And you know, in keeping with that, let's give honorable mention to another of my more favorite of the chapters that I have read, which was Michael W. Ford's first of two chapters that he contributed about, well, it's basically about Enochian magic and the Nephilim. It starts on page 117, called Azazel and the Rephaim.
Yeah, Michael is extraordinarily researched, and and even beyond that, you know, he takes his research, and what he said is that he's not necessarily trying to do a reproduction. He's not necessarily trying to perform the rites as they were performed, you know, thousands of years ago, because like you said, we're in a different energetic vibration entirely. And so he's bringing it into this era and saying, here's the powers and the forces and those archetypes that we can now draw from. And then has a pretty usable system. I mean, I've actually worked through some of his Luciferian ideals and rites, and I can't say that it's anything other than very, very practical and quite potent.
Yeah, and his presentation of his research is extremely scholarly and yet approachable, which is unique in a lot of ways. People get left behind sometimes not being able to make that transition, but I think he does a really good job. And that's the other thing I would mention to people listening to this conversation right here, is that what you've provided, I think, with this anthology is a really approachable and readable book with regards to some pretty heavy duty topics, and you know, you've put it in a very simplified manner, but yet still retaining the depth of the subject matter, which, you know, segueing right into your chapter, which is titled Gods of the Kali Yuga, which was a bold but completely relevant topic, by the way, for you to take on this book, I think.
No, yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's to address, first of all, the approachability of it. I think that is really that should be of the primary concern for the occult mentors, the occult teachers and authors and presenters out there at this moment. If you look at the way occultism and really all of spirituality has been approached up until this moment, it's been really obfuscated that the figureheads of all of the major and even the minor spiritual currents out there have done their best to make sure that it seems like it's completely out of reach for the average person. So that way you need to rely on some priest or pope or Templar to decode it for you. And, you know, we're just at a point in our evolution, maybe, that it's not necessarily so unattainable anymore. And so, yeah, I think that the approachability has got to be there, because, you know, people aren't necessarily looking for something that they can sit around and sip tea and intellectualize about anymore. They're looking at something that they can use, because I think people feel on a very integral level that something, I don't want to say that something's missing, but that there is more than what's apparent, and that they need to tap into it. There's a sense of urgency. And so, you know, having that approachability of going, you know, look, it is an intense subject matter. I mean, especially the anthology of sorcery, and this is Black Magic, The Left Hand Path. This is some intense stuff, but that doesn't mean that it's got to be something that should scare you away from looking into, nor is it something that's going to be too heavy or too deep for you to really grasp, that you can wrap your head around it. And really, I mean, for the most part, I think especially with a work like this anthology of sorcery, that you can look at it and well, I mean, it makes sense. It really is laid out in a way by all of the contributors in a way that you go, oh, well, yeah, of course.
Okay, and you know that this will become more apparent as we unfold this conversation for those listening. Let's jump into the fact that you ask several pertinent questions starting out in this chapter, the first chapter of the anthology. For example, you ask why now are so many rising up to take the challenge of becoming, quote, world creators and reality rearrangers. Can you speak to that from your perspective writing this? Why is it? Why do you think now is the time, Eric?
Well, you know, and there are a lot of I think theories that I've kind of tried to run with, and you know, I really fell pretty heavily on the whole Abraham Maslow kind of philosophy that especially in the Western world we have our base needs met. I mean, even if you're, you know, on food stamps and you know, you're not doing well in life, you're better off than most people have been for most of human history. And if that gives you a unique advantage to maybe pay attention to things that are a bit beyond, you know, having to go hunt for your food or, you know, seek shelter lest you're eaten by, you know, so whatever roaming predators are out there. So that could possibly be an explanation, but another could be, you know, so something about the time itself, about the both the people that are here now, but also the energetic frequency that is currently being transmitted or generated, that we're in a very unique time. And, you know, this is an idea that's been thrown out there by, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson was one who did kind of tap on this idea of kind of a concurrence or concrescence in time vibration. And we're in a very unique time itself that allows for us to really reach towards that, you know, like you said, the you know, world creators, reality rearrangers. So, you know, and the article, the chapter that I wrote for this, it really dives fully into the answering that question. And you can look at this from the Hindu and yogic perspective of the different ages of mankind or of existence of life here on Earth, and these are separated into these ages or these yugas. Supposedly we're in the Kali Yuga, the darkest of the dark, and it's kind of seen to be a falling state. We've fallen from grace, we've fallen away from the gods and away from our divinity. That we've lost something and now we're kind of wandering aimlessly. And really in this article, I counter that in pointing out that's not necessarily the case, that as we can see, the human race is evolving at an exponential rate and it's doing so for, I think, some very, very specific reasons.
Yes, and you know, you speak as eloquently put about our aeon right now as you understand it, with the Kali Yuga representing an aeon or an age for those listening. And you talk about the what makes it so special, you say, is that the very vibrations of it have shaken the human soul and awoken the God within. And that's really the theme that you're consistent with this message that you bring, your website being becomealivinggod.com. You know, this is the message, this is the core teaching. And this is what you've distilled this from as the meaning of magic, really, a magical approach to reality. And this is what's powerful about your message, Eric, I think, is because you've really done a great job. And I find it exciting and unique the way you've done it with the subject. That the reason why I think it's a bold stand or a bold tact on your part is because, you know, you're obviously a Westerner. You're not a Hindu, right? You know, so you're not a Vedic, but yet you speak with authority about your understanding of this teaching. I think that's really commendable. And so let's break it down and unpack it a little bit for the listeners. When we're talking about these four great yugas in your chapter, the great stages or ages, you have the first one, which is the Sattva, right? That's the age of truth.
Yeah.
And so that's a no separation between human and divine, or a sense of oneness, right?
Yeah. And, you know, and you can look at these ages, and they're almost seen by I think most people who really dig into and research into the Vedas, they're almost seen as being super literal, as far as the, you know, the gods and the asuras are walking the earth with man. And it's really easy to kind of condense that idea into a historical time frame, and I don't necessarily think that that's the case. I mean, really, when you look at time itself, that the time is neither a line nor is it a circle, as some people posit, but it's actually a dot. Everything is happening at once, and so there's no real historical context from any kind of spiritual vantage. So it's not necessarily that at one point in history the gods were walking amongst us, or that we were one, but I think this is referring more to a more internal state and a point of that union between the macrocosm and the microcosm, really the greater and then the finite. And this would represent, I guess, the point of that union in a completely natural, organic state, that there was no separation between the divine and between the finite beings, the carnal human beings, that there was no distinction, there was no us and them, which as we can see just from the way that we observe things currently, that's definitely not the case. That we do see not only separation and distinction between us and the divine, but between us and everything else. I mean, we for some reason we believe that there's us and then there's an external world, but the other people that are out there are part of that external world, and they're looking at us and we're part of their external world. I mean, it's all a really funny Maya. That really is what the whole Maya concept is. It's not that this world isn't real, because, you know, I do rock climbing and some mountain climbing, and I know that if I fall, that rock is very, very real. And so that's not the idea of Maya, but the Maya is the thinking that you're separate from any of it.
Excellent. That was an excellent response. You know, what I really took from reading this was you actually awakened a certain a perception in me that what this all represented, these different ages and the descriptions therein, was like the unfolding of human consciousness, the awakening of human awareness in the telling of these different ages. It's like a description of different phases of consciousness or awareness as it's developing and awakening towards the final phase. You know, the final integrated state, which let's continue and see how that actually unfolds. Well, the next yuga is the Treta, and that's the individualization. That's where we get into this idea of the, like you said, of the distinction between the other and us and the super other, the divine walking with humanity. So now you have that greater and lesser, you know, the micro and the macro coexisting in the moment per se.
Right, exactly. And you know, in the first yuga, the first age, according to the mythology, that once again there was no separation between the divine and humans. And so the real threat, the only threat to be you know, argued against or to be fought against, was of a very, very supernatural high order, as we see these descending, that the threats and the dangers and the obstacles become, I think, more and more mundane, and there's a sense of these divine figures, these gods, these devas that come rushing in to save humanity and to save really at that point in the first age to save themselves, because there is no separation. In the you know, in the second age, yeah, we're looking at that they're still here, they're still amongst us, but we understand that we're separate from them. And really, like you said, you can take this you can take it from a mythological historical perspective and say, yeah, in some golden age we lived amongst the gods, or you can take it from a very personal perspective and say, well, okay, this is a very close representation of the evolution of the individual. You can see that with the growth of an infant, that an infant in the very first part of its life really doesn't know that it's separate from its environment, and definitely doesn't know that it's a separate thing from its mother. And at some point, there's that point of looking at you going, oh my God, I'm not you, actually. I'm different than you, and I'm just cuddling up against you. And really, that's kind of what that stage, that age that we're talking about now, represents, is that point where we kind of looked at the divine and said, oh, we're not the same. We're still amongst them. There's still that intermingling, but there's a recognition of that separateness.
All right, and then moving on to the third yuga is the Tvapara, which is the individual assertion. Now it's the beginning of war and murder and what you call self-segregation.
Yeah. You know, then this is, at this point, basically the gods begin to leave the earth realm, or the human species, really, and kind of leave us a bit alone. They're still there. They can still come and go. But it's almost like the infant's now grown up and you know, is going to college or has gotten a job, and you're still welcome back at mom and dad's place, but you know, you also need to go home to your own spot at some point. So, you know, it's that further separation between man and that original divinity that's there. Yeah, and the threat then becomes man. It becomes the threat to his own self, rather than having these external, chaotic, you know, abysmal supernatural forces that are assailing us. That it's a very real threat of us destroying ourselves, which is at this point, you know, possibly a greater threat on this planet than it ever has been.
Yeah, like we probably have still the bleed over from the last age into the current age, if we're going to follow this timeline, because we still see that going on, the prevalence of that in everything that's happening with the self-segregation. But, you know, the fourth age being this Kali Yuga that we're in, which is, you've represented as the Dark Age, which that's how it's commonly referred to as well, or the Age of Strife, where the soul divorced from the divine, you have the world being filled with famine and faithlessness and hopelessness. And that's really, in many ways, if you look at, you know, like the current events in the news, for example, today, you find the prevalent evidence of this so easily, you know, at Facebook memes that just, you know, not to say, I'm not trying to focus on the negative to get everybody all freaked out, like I'm trying to say there's no, all hope is lost here. I'm just saying, in a very realistic, very sober manner, that there is a sense that we're in this place where the soul seems divorced from the divine, in the sense where you have a people with a crisis of faith. There's a rise in atheism in cities and in you know, institutional learning facilities now. And there is a sense, I mean, there, where I came from in the northeast of America, there's a huge rise in suicide, in people who are killing themselves. You know, this is a prevailing sense of hopelessness, which drives to end one's life, you know. And so we have to acknowledge that this is so. And now, keeping with the theme, though, this current age beginning, according to your reckoning in the chapter, at the midnight, February 18th, 3102 BCE, aligning with the beginning of the Bronze Age, right, which allowed for, as you point out, the greater weapons and the, you know, vehicles of war. And of course, we could elaborate on, you know, just the organization of military combat, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And this is you know, this is really when civilization starts to spring up, and I mean, civilization is great and all, but it is also obviously, you know, self-segregation. It's you know, we are this tribe and you are that tribe, and therefore we're separate. And you know, there's an interesting, I mean, it really is interesting, because you can look at the presentation of reality right now in our current time, and it seems to be pretty bad. I mean, things seem pretty bad, but seem is a, you know, we've got to keep that in mind, that this is just what's apparent, because I mean, things really are better for more people than it's ever been. But there's that idea of that it's not, and people are I think at a unique point of awakening. You know, for instance, we didn't, the separation between man and divine, that never really happened. It just seems to have happened, that there seems to be a divide. You know, just like there seems to be two separate people speaking right now to each other, it's really just, you know, one consciousness, and that can kind of be taken as like this hippie, feel good philosophy. But really, there's no way of really saying where I stop and you begin, or where I stop and my external environment begins, because it all is linked together and it all flows to each other. And so, with that, there's something to keep in mind, which is that what is apparent may not necessarily be what is real, and so we can look at that and go, yeah, from the Bronze Age forward, that it's been we've devolved into just greater and greater warlike tendencies and greater evil, but you know, I think I present maybe a different side of that, which is that this is the necessary growth pattern for our species. That here's where this is all kind of leading to. Just so I can, you know, go ahead and spoil kind of the punchline, is that we're not trying to get back to the divine. That I don't buy into the fact that this earth plane, or that this time that we're existing in is bad, or not, is less desirable, or less connected, or less of anything. This is an evolution that we are in the middle right now. I think the human species is in the middle of possibly our greatest evolutionary leap since the human brain expanded a few million years ago. That we're expanding in a completely different way, but just like any kind of growth, at some point you've got to leave the nest. You've got to leave mom and dad's house. And that's really the point we're at in this Kali Yuga. We're not shunned. We haven't been shunned by the gods or by the divine, nor have we necessarily, left them and waving our middle finger in the air as we drive off. That we as a species are growing up. We're ready to accept ourselves as our own gods, and we don't need to have the same kind of archetypes that we had before. We don't need to have the same sort of approach to godhood as we have in the past, where we're really, what you can see this as is almost as a cycle, an evolutionary cycle for sure, where at one point in our evolution, either as individuals or as a species, we were not separate from the divine. That as an individual, you had full awareness of your own divinity. You had full awareness that you could indeed create worlds and destroy worlds. That you had all power, all knowledge, and you had infinite presence. Now, we've fallen away from that, but only to rediscover that through our own means. I mean, it's like when you once again, with the example of leaving your parents' home, you know, a lot of the values that they have, you know, at first you may shun and you may go against, but I think a lot of the times you kind of come around and a few years down the road, you can sit around and have a beer with your dad and go, oh, wow, yeah, you were actually right about a lot of the stuff, but I had to discover it for myself. And I think that's where we're at in our evolution, is discovering our godhood for ourselves rather than relying on it coming from an external source.
You know, that's why I enjoy talking to you, Eric, and why I wanted to bring you back on is because of the unique way that you set up this material, because it's really so very optimistic, actually. It really is a very proactive and dynamic message to people listening, that they can really, you know, for those that feel unencumbered by the usual resistance and prejudice that comes with looking at the material that you have, what you work with. And that's why I wanted to have you come on. That's why I enjoy these conversations we have, and I think that's why our conversations are the most popular ones in our podcast archives right now, because this is just the time is right. And now let's shift gears in this talk and talk about how you put it, is that when the world is in serious threat, Vishnu, the preserver, assumes a body, or I put in an avatar in my thinking, you know, and that's right along lines with the teaching, right? That descends to save the earth. And you talk about the distribution of this avatar through the quote-unquote kalpa, which is the cycle of the completed cycle of the four yuga ages. And in this kalpa, there are 10 savior manifestations, right? And let's talk about these manifestations and how they break down for each age. I can just break it down for the listeners that what we have is the distribution of the avatars goes like this. The first, the Satya, has 3 times that the avatar comes to save the world from the chaotic elemental forces of nature and the cosmos. So it's more on the earth level of threat, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the earth level and the earth and kind of supernatural maybe level, where we're talking about the cosmos and the mysteries therein. So yeah.
And the next one, the Treta, is the avatar comes 4 times as the preserver, saving the world from the demon kings. Now, this is a new development in this timeline.
It is, and you know, and one thing that's really interesting about the Vedas is they'll make references to things like that, the demon kings. And my first question is, well, give me their names and their signs and how to call them, because that sounds really cool. they'll make allusions like that. The demon kings, the demons, as I understand them, are embodiments of pure, unrestrained power, and so you know, as things are forming, and as this supposed separation is taking place between everything is beginning to separate and segregate, that this power, this unrestrained power, begins to take form and becomes a very real threat to humanity. And once again, let's look at that from a more microcosmic level, the individual level of your own personal spiritual unfolding, that there reaches a point right before any kind of real illumination of dark night of the soul, of having the power that you're invoking itself begins to kind of swallow you and becomes a threat in itself. And so this is really the stage of that age and the need of the preserver to come and to save everything, all of existence. And at that point, it's not even necessarily saving humans as a species or as individuals, but just saving existence, just keeping the molecules spinning.
And so now the next one is the Dvapara, which is twice the avatar descended in this age to save mankind from wiping themselves out with stone maces and wooden spears.
Yeah. And that's, you know.
It's like Zachariah Sitchin's The Wars of Gods and Men or whatever, you know, the time of Conan or something or whatever. I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, and that's a pretty brutal imagery for sure. That you know, mankind gets to that point. And well, and we can see that in a lot of mythologies. I mean, even if you look at the Judeo-Christian mythology of Cain and Abel, Cain didn't tie Abel down with to an altar and slit his throat. He crashed him over the head with a rock. And so that's really the stage. And, you know, you can see this. One thing I absolutely love about looking at spiritual systems is that they're all telling very similar stories, and they're just using different vocabulary. And so we can see kind of that, some of that there, where you have very rudimentary tools, and then basically as soon as people can start making tools, the first tools they start making are weapons of war, which you know is that in itself is interesting to look at. One of the discoveries that I'm trying to follow pretty closely are these caves in Europe and Scandinavia. Fell Holes Cave is a great one that is fascinating to me, that they're finding these relics as being some of the actual first pieces of art and first engravings that humans ever made were talismanic, that they were very obviously magical amulets meant for inspiring fertility or for a good hunt or this kind of thing. So, you know, humans basically, as soon as we were able to take objects and start fashioning them, that we wanted to do two things with them. We wanted to have magic in order to have greater control over our world, and weapons of war to defend ourselves and possibly to attack.
Yeah, I mean, this is prevalent in the extant archaeological data, that's for sure. And now moving forward to the final Yuga, the Kali Yuga, which we find ourselves in now, not once so far has the Kali Yuga seen any sort of intervention from the Avatar. And as you point out, this is because this Yuga will only see a single Avatar, the final Avatar, right? Kalki. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, and to go back again to the analogy of you know, children and the family structure, that there gets to be a point, and you know, being parents, I think we can agree on this, that there gets to be a point where you got to let your kid fall down and scrape their knees from time to time. You can't always be hovering there to save them from themselves, and really. It is really easy for people, especially people of any kind of religious devotional type of system, to look at where we're at as a society, as individuals, and to look at this layout of these ages and say, wow, you know, we've been cast out by the gods, that we're not worthy, and they recognize that we're not worthy, and so they have abandoned us. And really, you know, and children will see, well, children can think that if they fall down and scrape their knees and they see that you're just standing there watching them, they're going to blame you. They're going to be pissed that you weren't there to catch their fall. But
yeah.
There is that point where it's like, no, you're a big boy. You can get up, brush yourself off and get on with it. And what we're seeing then is that that these ages really represent a greater level of trust in humankind by whatever powers are out there. Now, I've seen this myself in droves with dealing with the evocations, the channelings, the divinations that I do, speaking with the spirits that I speak with, and communing with these supernatural forces, that they're becoming more and more communicative, that they're actually much more willing to divulge information, to be of assistance, but they're not intervening unless they're called upon. And that's it's a really interesting thing. They're saying, no, you need to handle your own problems now. Now the last Avatar is Kalki, the destroyer. That this is not a manifestation of Vishnu, the preserver, but it's a manifestation of Shiva or Kali, the destroyer. And, you know, that can be taken very apocalyptically, for sure, that you can look at that and go, well, okay, so the next time that we're going to see some kind of divine intervention is going to be when Kalki comes with a flaming sword and devours all of this earth in shadows. And, yeah, that can be terrifying. But, you know, there's another interpretation of that. I was doing a series of workings in right around 2001, working with specifically with Lucifer, with Azazel, with some other very, very high-level demonic figures who kept on talking about destruction, that you know, you will come to us in order for you to be destroyed. I'm going, well, I don't want to be destroyed, man. That's, you know, that's not what I'm here for.
right. It's counterproductive to this whole thing, right?
Right, yeah. And then they began telling me about the different words of power, and that you will be given a word of power which by its very utterance will destroy all of the universe. And I'm going, well, who would want that? And you know, you have that mythology in a lot of different religions and systems of a word or a name that it's ineffable because it will destroy everything. Well, what it's actually destroying is not the world or the universe. It's destroying your perception in that moment. That in that moment, you kind of come back to that point of non-separation, and you go, "Oh, okay." You know, it's that moment of, you know, sitting down and having that beer with your dad, and going, "Okay, well, yeah, we're not all that different after all." That the illusion of separateness becomes destroyed, and therefore all of the world, which is not outside of ourselves but encompassed within our own beings, is seen for what it really is. And you know, in the Vedas, they do say that all of the devas or gods are manifest here in the human body, and we can look at that and go, okay, so when we reach that point, either as individuals or as a species, and really those are linked in, because if you have enough individuals experiencing something, it becomes a meme. It becomes a current that's really unshakable. And that's the point we're at right now in our evolution, I think, is that we're at a point where there are enough people locking onto this idea of their own godhood. And it's creating a momentum that is absolutely unstoppable. And that's why I'm comfortable standing up and saying, look, you become a living God. I mean, it's not about me. I'm doing my thing. You can do your thing, and let's do it together, because we're in the middle of this phase of destruction that Kalki, you know, is not going to necessarily descend from the heavens wearing crimson robes, but it's going to awaken inside of the human psyche. And yeah, there's that external crisis that becomes manifested of our destructive nature, for sure. That's hard to shake. I mean, we basically are pack hunting apes of a sort. And so we do have that intense violence about us, but that, when it's funneled in a productive direction, that becomes the key to really awakening the God within, to destroying the illusory perception of ourselves. And then once that's gone, then the destruction of our whole universe around us. And at that point, when we become creators, and not some point in the future, but right now, in this very moment, as we become creators, that the world is destroyed and instantly is replaced. Once again, we can see this echoed in various religions, and you can see this in the Book of Revelation, that the stars will fall from their places, and a new heaven and a new earth will be made there. And so this is a revelation, a prophecy of human potential, that we are able to simultaneously destroy all things and then create all things, and you know, we're doing it at a quantum level, really. I mean, that's that really is, as you look more and more into the whole field of quantum research, it's validating really all of this, where individual perception determines reality. And you know, people who want to scoff that off and go, well, yeah, that's just some weird philosophy of you know, individual reality. No, go check out the double slit experiment. I mean, if you're observing an electron as being a wave, it'll be a wave. If you want it to be a particle, it's going to be a particle. And it's completely dependent on the observer. We are shifting our reality in every moment, and it's only at this particular precise minute that we as individuals and as a species are becoming consciously aware of our own godhood. It's always been there. We've always been living gods. we just never had the audacity to accept that before.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, you said in your chapter of the new work, the Anthology of Sorcery, Volume 1, you said that the path to the more obscure realms of experience requires immersion into several systems, as well as an innate knack for these experiences to begin with. Now, I really couldn't agree with you more on this, but I was wondering if you might elaborate on this a bit. And why this is the case, do you think?
Well, I mean, the first aspect of that is pretty obvious, that that you do have to look beyond just one system. You, the ages past, whether we're seeing that from a historical perspective or from a personal evolutionary perspective, that what worked for us before was devotion and was almost a clingy attachment to the externalized God force. And so that really required an eye single to one particular paradigm or system, and it's definitely requisite for the real spiritual adventurer to look out and to check out everything, especially that which has up until this point been forbidden, and really delve into all of it. And now, There is the matter. The second matter is I think the more interesting one of having to have kind of a predisposition for all of this. That's boggled my mind for a long time. I mean, I've taught at this point personally. I mean, thousands of people I've taken and taught them how to get this power and how to use it. Now, Everybody can take this and can use it, whether we're talking magic or prayer or meditation or whatever, that there's a field of power, a world of energy that we're immersed in, and everybody can reach into it and manipulate it to some extent. But you have certain folks who are able to do that at a level that is just mind-blowing. And having that predisposition, once you get your hands on even just a little bit of this, you almost get an instant addiction to it, an addiction to really your own spiritual unfolding. And from that point forward, I mean, you're never going to be the same. You know, once you drank from the skull of Kali, you're never going to be the same. And so it's hard to pin down what it is that makes some people predisposed to this than others. Some might chalk it up to being something to do with reincarnation. I haven't completely written that off, but I haven't completely accepted that whole ideology either. I think it could very well have something to do with simple genetic evolution on a scale that we're just not seeing, because we're just barely figuring out what, you know, genes are anyways. So I think
that's an interesting take, though, right there. And if you look at, I don't know how familiar you are with the works of say Lawrence Gardner or Prince Nicholas Devere with the Dragon Legacy and the Dragon Court material,
mm-hmm.
but there's a lot of evidence there that they review and present which really gives credence to the concept of a magical gene in a magical subspecies of humanity. As a matter of fact, I mean, Prince Nicholas goes so far as to call it like the elven race or the werewolf race or the vampire race, depending on the culture that you're talking about, which kind of lines up with Tolkien, really. And it's not totally beyond the realm of possibility, actually, listeners, because there's a lot to be said for the source material which Tolkien drew from, the pool that he dipped into to give the world the Lord of the Rings saga was a source material going back to prehistory of what I would call the pre-European tribe traditions of what is the Europe before Christianity conquered it. You know, the heathens. Systems that existed in pre-heathen systems, right? So, I mean, there's a lot more there, I think, than people realize. And you allude to that as well in your chapter when you talk about how we don't really know a lot of this anymore because it's been excised, it's been repressed. You know, the Norse myth and the pre-Norse and all that, what we're talking about right now, the there's legends and tales and myths that end up surviving within esoteric systems. Some of the forbidden arts actually contain all that's left of what could be called Western shaman tradition, right?
Yeah, you know, and this is a, I think this is a good deal of the confusion that exists about my work specifically, is that for a good deal of the last few thousand years, at least, I mean, probably going as far back as Sumeria, that these ancient secrets needed to be guarded, so they weren't destroyed, and so they were guarded and hidden within boxes of symbolism. That I mean, really, if you're dealing with any kind of spiritual system, or specifically with any kind of magical system, you're going to have to wade really deep into a lot of symbolism and decode a lot of it, and so they're hiding this within these boxes of symbolism that you have to decode, and even to get to those boxes in the first place is hard. To get to that knowledge, the job of the occultist was really to keep this knowledge and protect it from being destroyed by the different tribes out there. Really, that's what it comes down to. The different tribes of other bipedal, you know, pack hunting apes that are out there trying to get the information that you have and destroy it so they can try to say that theirs is better. And so the occultist has kind of been a protector of the secret knowledge. But just like the devas and the asuras aren't necessarily here to protect the human race anymore, because they don't need it. The human race doesn't need to be protected from this knowledge anymore, nor does this knowledge need to be protected from the human race anymore. That at this point, and only really at this point, at this peak, is the human race ready to embrace our infinite potential. And so, you know, my work and the work of a growing number of others, yourself included, I would even say, is to bring these esoteric, these secret things and put them in the light and give them to people and say, here are these tools. These are the tools that are left over from when we didn't know or didn't think that we were separate from God, when we all knew that we were all the creator. This is what's left of it, and here's how we can use it, and here's how we can get back the rest of it. That is delving into a realm of the forbidden, where, I mean, forbidden to the systems that exist out there, the religious and political systems, which rely solely on the idea of personal disempowerment. That, I mean, if the individual has no power, then they need, you know, Big Brother or the church to guide them and guard them. But as soon as the individual accepts full responsibility for their own existence, that all of a sudden there's not much need to keep paying these guys to keep doing what they do. So those systems are obviously rallying against any form of personal liberation, but then you have on the other side of the street, you have the folks that have been protecting this knowledge for millennia, who aren't ready to give up their guard, that they're not ready to accept that we won the war, that we as a human species won the war, and we're at the finish line, and we're ready to take on everything. It is optimistic, but I don't think it's Pollyannish. I think I know from the numbers that I'm seeing that a lot of other people are seeing the same thing, that, oh my God, I can have an alarming amount of control over existence itself through, you know, just these slight alterations in my consciousness. And there are methods that awaken that in a very real way, and so, you know, we're ready for that, and you know, we're taking it. We're the title of that chapter, Gods of the Kali Yuga. You know, you would ask, you know, well, who are the gods of the Kali Yuga? It's you know, we don't have Vishnu here protecting us, and Brahma has kind of done his job of creating everything and putting it into motion. Shiva is still waiting in silent meditation for the end of the Kalpa, and so the gods of the Kali Yuga is man. We're the only divine beings that were left on this planet, and so we're really finally stepping up to the throne that was passed to us.
Man, you just jumped to the punchline, didn't you? You tried to do it before, and you just finished it that time. But, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, words of power from EA co-editing everybody over at becomealivinggod.com. I mean, this is the real thrust of your message, isn't it? And I think that it's point out so much that it is optimistic in the sense that, well, look, for example, you said in the chapter that the Kali Yuga is no more of a decline into decadence than the shift of the individual from puberty to adulthood. And that is so poignant an illustration, which really conveys, I think, the what could be perceived as the tragic feeling woven into the transitional experience from child to adult. That, as speaking as a parent of four children myself, and you yourself are a parent, so we know firsthand that the witness of that experience. As a parent, you watch your child grow up, and you know that the process of growing up for them is this sort of sad time, because they're sort of shedding the innocence of the youth as they become more tuned into reality and tuned into their response and approach to reality. And this is what we're dealing with when we're talking about these systems, is what we choose to take on as our approach, and how we choose to fine-tune our senses with regards to our experience. And, you know, you point out, too, in this chapter that the human race longs for the comfort and familiarity of ages past. Why do you think that is, Eric? Why do we fall back on that so much?
Oh, man. And, well, I mean, we absolutely do. And it's what Terence McKenna called the archaic revival, that humanity as a whole is having a hard time grasping and really wrapping our heads around our own independence and our own godhood, really. That we're having a hard time accepting responsibility for our position as creators of all things. And we're kind of looking back to, as McKenna puts it, the last sane moment, which really was really in the grasslands of Africa. That we're looking for that time when we didn't really have these wars, we didn't really have these the responsibilities of civilization building, of empire building, and now of becoming gods and creators of reality. Just like the ongoing analogy that you want to move home sometimes. You kind of get homesick and want to go back to mom's house and go let her make dinner and do your laundry for you. But when you grow up, you do find that there's a lot of pleasure and a lot of great things that come from that independence. And so as a species, we're there. We're absolutely there. And so there is that sense of, you know, longing for the ages past, longing for a time when things were simpler and we were coddled. And once again, we can take that from a historical perspective, but the other perspective is that what I see a lot in, specifically in occultism, is that people have kind of gotten this idea of this existence on this physical plane as being not great, that this is a lesser state, and specifically getting the idea that it needs to be escaped from, that we need to get away from here, and go back to the divine, and, you know, merge our identities and our power and our energy back with the all. And that's not evolution at all, because that's where we came from, and that's really, I think that's kind of the underlying, maybe less obviously pointed out message in my article, Gods of the Kali Yuga, is that uh, that we're not trying to get back and move back into mom and dad's house. If you're an adult and you're moving back into mom and dad's house, well, you got to ask yourself what you did wrong. And so in the experience of spiritual progression, experience your own divinity, experience that connection with the divine, but we have individualized ourselves for a reason, and we're here on this physical plane for a reason. This is uncharted territory spiritually. I mean, this is a completely new experience, and it is uncomfortable, I think, for the individual, especially the individual who is in the middle of their own awakening, to be here in this physical world where we seem to have so little power. But what really we're doing is we're learning how to take this and make it our own. This physical plane, this is where the heavens are being built currently. This is the new home of the gods. That someday, long into the future, that there will be another spiritual generation that will be looking back at this and going, hey, I would love to go home to the earth physical plane where things were so much simpler and everything was connected. Because this is the outflowing of evolution, the outflowing of the condensation of reality from a spiritual cosmological point of view, is that things are expanding and we're not necessarily trying to escape, when we shouldn't be trying to escape this planet or this earth or life to get just anywhere better. And if there is any kind of message inside of the whole mythology of reincarnation, it's that we're going to keep coming back, that we belong here, and we need to do something with this plane and with our selves in these physical forms that is a bit more important than our comfort of going back to mom and dad's house.
Well put, Eric. You know, and also I just want to say that was a very unique and a really a great interpretation of McKenna's concept of the archaic revival that I think is new and not hasn't been really looked at from that perspective. So I really commend you in looking at and seeing it from that light, because I think that really makes sense. And, you know, you point out in this article that it has taken us an incredible descent. This is a quote right directly from it, into darkness, into opposition. It's taken us an incredible descent into darkness and into opposition for us to finally recognize our destiny and our birthright. And this, once again, is one of those optimistic, really, it's packed with optimism, because the statement transmutes seemingly negative and painful experiences into positive growth and insight. And this is really the I think the prevailing theme that makes you a popular voice out there, because you have this is what you're offering is, hey, this is a way for folks who are open to this approach to reality. This is a way to sort of reinterpret, or, and I use the word transmute, our negative pasts, the bad things that weigh us down, the judgments we hold against ourselves even and others who have hurt us in the past, and a way to get free of that baggage and to become lightened, to gain a vehicle to pass lighter through this than to be weighed down with what could be called karmic debt or such, or pay a psychic price for your experiences, right?
Yeah. No, it's the real point, I think, is that everybody can look at once again discomfort, painful situations in life, and even just seemingly powerless situations, circumstances, and just completely buckle under it. And man, there is so much power in just kind of switching it around and going, well, now what if I could maybe shift things a little bit more, just a little bit, and I make a huge leap. I do make a huge leap with the statement, become a living God. That entire thing is, okay, well, it's a process of becoming. It's a process of doing that, you know, one step at a time with, you know, with whatever you have in front of you. That's, you know, people ask me a lot where to start, you know, and especially people who are being called to their own awakening. They go, well, what do I start with? And I always have to say, well, you know, look at your life. What do you want to change? What could be better? I mean, that's where you start. You start, you clean your own doorstep before you go, you know, start changing the world. And so just look at your life and go, well, you know, I could do this. I could have more enjoyment, pleasure, peace, happiness, through these alterations. And then I guarantee you there are methods to do that. There are methods that exist within your very reach, not difficult methods either, that you can apply to make these things happen in a way that can be described only as miraculous. And once you have enough of those experiences, you start to question your powerlessness. And that's, I think that's the great catalyst that we have now, is that people are questioning a lot right now. You know, people are questioning their church and their government right now quite a bit. You know, questioning the family values and social values, and everything is being questioned. And that's excellent. That's the point that we need to be at, because that is the catalyst for change, is to start bringing these things into question. And so, yeah, that's a
It's a scary prospect. It's scary is what it is. It really is for a lot of folks, because it's something that, you know, you point out, it's we run from our own darkness. Again, your words, that we hide from our own macabre impulses to discover the human limits, because deep down we know that we have none, in fact, and that frightens us worse than death, doesn't it, Eric?
Absolutely. You know, and I saw a quote. I don't remember who it was. It was you know, in Gandhi or you know, it was somebody that I would not have really expected this from. They said, you know, the mankind's or the individual's worst fear is not that he's powerless. People like to think that that's the worst fear, is that they have no power, but really the worst fear, the absolute worst fear, is that we are powerful beyond measure. And yeah, that's that does scare people quite a bit. I mean, it scares me. I'll tell you what, that's something that shakes me quite a bit in my work, and especially, you know, I'm doing this day in and day out, working with people and you know, in building my own empire, that I push it and I keep seeing how far I can go before I reach the border and I reach that point where my power can no longer be effective. That and I haven't found that border, and it's a little scary. It's like, you know, you're wading out into the ocean and you're waiting for that drop off into the abyss, and you're pretty sure it's going to come, but you're just not finding it. And so, you know, you're kind of pushing your toe to the edge, pretty scared. And that's good. You know, fear is meant to warn you of danger, not necessarily to keep you away from it. It's giving you a heads up. The fear emotion is very valuable on an evolutionary impetus manner, but it's not necessarily to make you run the other way. It's to alert you. So, you know, be alert. Yeah, and you know, I'll be the first to say it. There are dangers. There are dangers in exploring your own infinite power, most definitely. But the fear of those dangers should keep you alert and vigilant, but not keep you from taking the journey. That would be absurd, to not take the journey because you're afraid of what you might find.
Excellent point. Excellent point. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the word from E.A. Coetting, according to his chapter from this amazing anthology of sorcery, is that the age of worship has ended and we are now free to become God. I mean, I laugh, but it's a powerful statement. It's a powerful declaration of self-affirmation, of self-actualization. You pointed out earlier in this conversation, you talked about Abraham Maslow. Mm-hmm. And I am slightly familiar with his work. He's part of the whole self-actualization movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's for folks, that's the reference, that the reference point that, you know, we both are coming from comfortably, because I know from just a little bit of your own past that you, as well as I, have gone through many trials and tribulations on the ascent to a place where we feel comfortable because of practice, because of actual use and taking on board these concepts and integrating them into our everyday life in a way that makes for results that give us more enthusiasm and more encouragement and more optimism, because we really do, and I know I speak for you on this one right here, Eric, that we really do believe that these are attainable goals, and that we merely need to shift our understanding of the answers to these questions to see that they are attainable, that the answers are there for us all. And, you know, because we are tooting your horn right here, Eric, because this is your work that we're exploring, I really like the way you interpret the Apocalypse of St. John the Blessed. You lay out that it's laid out like the common mystical path of enlightenment is, and it's, you find a similarity between this and what we've already discussed with regards to the inner path that could be perceived from the yogic cosmology, that's the term you use. I wonder if you might explain this a little bit further just for the listeners, because I think it's really important. It really does. I thought it was exciting. It was a unique interpretation as well of this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it really, and I had somebody tell me this, and I don't even remember who it was, but you know, I got really caught up in the you know, I guess the apocalypse scare, maybe you could call it, the you know, looking into the conspiracy theories and government control of everything and the all of that, and I was waiting for it at any moment that the apocalypse would begin. And actually, I remember on the date set by Nostradamus, July, I think it was July 6th, 1999. I was waiting for, or June 6th, 1999. I don't remember now, but on that day, I was watching the news, and Nostradamus says something about that would be the beginning of the end. And I was watching the news all day waiting for it. And I had somebody tell me, look, you know that the whole thing with the apocalypse, that's a metaphor, right? Well, no, I didn't know that. Say, you know, tell me more. He says, well, yeah, it's a metaphor of the personal journey into your own, you know, your own self-realization, your own God realization, that you're journeying through a dark night of the soul. And on that other side is the awakening, and you can look at every step of the apocalypse. You know, regardless of what system you take it from, you can look at Ragnarok, or you can look at you know, the Great Cleansing, or you know, the Apocalypse of St. John, and all of them have very clear stages of decline and tribulation and a good deal of hereticism, where man turns against his own gods. And you know, it's been said that when Jesus comes back descending from the clouds with his crimson robes on, that those who are unbelievers are going to try to slay him with sticks and stones. And as he's descending from the clouds, very obviously, you know, the Savior, and it's said in just about every one of these systems, a similar thing, that man turns against his gods. And you can see this and see it as, once again, from a historical perspective, well, it's an amusing myth. But from a personal, individual perspective, you can look at each of these stages and go, wow, that's what I've journeyed through. And I think just about anybody who's gone through any kind of real hardship and has won and has come out the other side can look at it and identify that as well and say, oh, wow, you know, I've come through those exact stages in that order to get to the point of that that illumination. I mean, even the word apocalypse itself means revelation, even though we always, you know, identify that with the destructive aspect prior to the revelation. But that you come to this illumination of your own self that really can't be had without that destruction, and you know, goes back to what I was learning back in 2001 about these ineffable words that could destroy all things. Well, that destruction is not the destruction of all things. It's the destruction of the self. It's the whole, you know, the matrix, there is no spoon thing, that once you've destroyed yourself, that that all things become absolutely pliable.
And of course, with the apocalypse, once again, the idea of the revelations, the unveiling, the revealing, the unveiling of spiritual truth, and the unveiling or revealing of the not only the need but also the path, the need to walk the path and the path which must be walked. I'm just going to ask this question of you. Why is, in your own words, why is the black magician especially the most complex and evolved manifestation of the, quote, condensation of the omnipresent into a singularity?
Because the black magician has no limits. In the tantric systems, they have what they call the Kableshara, which, you know, you've got various levels of yogis and gurus, and above them all is the Kableshara, and he is the left-handed, really anti-guru. He's the black magician of the system, and he is said to be capable of doing anything, and that has a double meaning, that he has the power to do anything that he wants, but he also has no restriction, internal, external, from doing whatever he wants. He doesn't put restrictions on himself. And the modern black magician is most definitely the incarnation of absolute freedom, that you have, you know, power itself is by its nature, you know, unrestricted, unfettered. And it simply flows, and it can be directed, but it will flow. And so the black magician becomes the embodiment of that. It becomes the singularity, the gateway through which, you know, godhood flows into this plane, because he doesn't recognize rules. He doesn't recognize restrictions. You know, it's when we were talking a minute ago about kind of the pushing of your reality, just looking at the little, you know, whatever problems you might have, whatever things you might like to have, make better in your life and your reality, the black magician doesn't take anything off the table. You know, it's like, well, okay, so I'll go ahead and I'll give this ritual a try and see if it works. I mean, well, at least give it a try. What's it going to hurt? Sure, you know, there might be some danger involved, and so I'll take precautions if I can. But there's nothing that's taken off the table in pursuit of whatever it is you want. You know, it's doing whatever it takes. And you know, that's the spirit of freedom and the spirit of godhood, the spirit of once again, the singularity of infinite presence and infinite potential into that singular moment, that singular manifestation of a being that refuses to acknowledge that there are any limitations at all.
Excellent. You know, you mention in your work that the laws there are in fact laws and gods which govern each age, and you already kind of you already sort of gave the spoiler that we understand that the gods of this age, the gods of the Kali Yuga, are man, our humanity. Humanity is the gods of this age. And I really like the way you put it when you talk about how this age, the law that governs this age, which in the Hindu is the niyama or nayama, and this is what you call spiritual anarchy, you know, as you put it. And there is no way out but through once you start down that path, as you put it. Also, embracing the absence of control, you said, embracing every possibility amongst countless potentialities equally is the only path to power here and now. And I think that that's the main thrust of the message of this conversation, is the idea that what we're in the realm of the Kali Yuga is a realm of the potential for spiritual anarchy. And that's where I think I perceive your work and your message to be a launching pad from that. The idea that Anarchy is the idea of the removal of hierarchy from the experience. And that's what you offer. Your system, EA Coeting, is this become a living God system, as you point out, without initiation, without having to join a hierarchy and having to surrender or submit to a human hierarchy for access to your own empowerment. It is through this sense of spiritual anarchy that you could have gained direct access to your own potential, your own empowerment. Would you say?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And you know, and the word anarchy scares people. It scares a lot of people because you know, they think it means
chaos, right. You know, the misdefinition of it, the misdefining of it.
Well, and they extend it. The big issue is that people extend it beyond themselves. That they say, well, you know, if everybody's anarchistic, if we're living in an anarchic society, what will happen? Well, society, by definition, society cannot be anarchistic. That anarchy is a individual, personal approach. It's not a collective approach. It can't be, by definition. If there's a collective, there's a hierarchy. So it is the way that you choose to approach your own existence, and you know, politically, religiously, and most definitely spiritually, we are most definitely a law and gods unto ourselves, and that's once again that's in your personal realm. You don't need to extend that to you know, I mean, to a society, to this, especially the society and the system that exists currently. But in your own approach to your own life, and I think that's the biggest message that I always try to give people is you know, focus this on you, focus this on what you want to do with yourself. You know, and you always have those folks that come creeping out of the woodwork and say, hey, yeah, well, you know, why don't you levitate for me, Mr. Living God? And I go, well, I'll tell you what, why don't I teach you how to change your life and make it into whatever you want, and then I'll show you how to change the world around you and rearrange the molecules any way you want to, and then you'll know that you're a living God, because that's what this is all about, yourself. We got to move away from looking for evidence outside of ourselves. I mean, that's a, you know, that's really where this all comes full circle back to the beginning, in a matured way that we can come back to a realization that, well, yeah, there is no separation between us and the infinite. We're just a more evolved form of God.
A condensed point, right? A condensed point of the singularity, right? I like that idea too, that we are this condensed focal point, and it goes along with a lot of other teachings that are familiar to me, like the Druid teachings, which talk about basically the experiencer being the center of the universe.
Yeah, you know, you'll get that with a lot of the ancient pre-Abrahamic religions that you see that there is that Akashic black egg that all things come from, and that egg is the self. I mean, that is you know, at the root chakra, and it's at the crown as well. That the once again, all devas exist here within the human body. That we are, you know, man, you know, God made man in his own image. We've got this throughout every single mythology, that the individual is most definitely that we are the holographic microcosmic representation of the macrocosm, and we're in a very unique ability to evolve and grow and become more than just a homogeneous mass of light and sound. That we are forms. We are self-created forms. We're a self-created singularity, and that we're able to then replicate and expand even further beyond what would even be possible as that homogeneous field of light and sound.
Yes, it's also a different slant, a different take on the idea of, well, you know, the people today are so caught up in the whole alien astronaut idea of alien intervention into creation and intelligent design of the human species. But what you could see from what the way you've put it, the way you're interpreting this idea which is a perennial idea that recurs over and over again in many ancient cultures, the idea of the divine interacting or intervening into the development of the human species, the evolution of the human species, it could be seen as metaphor instead of literal interpretation. And once again, we're in that same realm of the idea that it's all aspects of human growth and development, especially the growth and development of human consciousness. And so this is the great mystery that I know you've found and I've found as well, decoding esoteric works and occult sciences and systems, as we both have extensively. This is one of the key mysteries that are at the core of these teachings and systems, is that it is a fractal hollow reality, H-O-L-O, as in hologram, where the idea is that the macrocosmic, microcosmic, as above, so below. The greater is contained within the lesser. And on that note, E.A. Coetting, this has been a fascinating and a fast-paced, really, 2 hour or hour and 40 minutes or something. I mean, we've covered a lot of ground in the conversation, but as all things must come to an end, all good things must come to an end as well. And I just want to thank you so much for making yourself available for our listeners here in the Middle Chamber with E.A. Coetting from becomealivinggod.com and talking about your new amazing work, Anthology of Sorcery, Volume 1, which is currently sold out. Are we looking for a second printing to be released anytime soon on the Volume 1, Eric?
You know, at this point, we are not looking at doing a second printing of it. You know, I have this ethical thing where when I say something, I try to stay true to it as best as I'm able to. And so, you know, when we did this, we said we were going to do a limited number of copies and we printed those, we sold those, I could make a pretty good chunk of change and release it again. But, my honor means something to me. And so we're talking right now about what we want to do for the next edition, the second edition, the book two, Anthology of Sorcery, with a whole new host of contributors, possibly inviting some of the others back to contribute to this, and see what we can do about making it more available. Maybe if we need to print more copies or something. I mean, the rate that those sold out was absurd. I mean, it was absurd. I mean, it's obvious. It's undeniable at this point that what I'm bringing out, and what a lot of people are bringing out, and specifically the contributors to this anthology are bringing to the public is wanted and needed at this moment. That it is hungered for, and people are ready for it. And people are, we are taking it. We are taking it, and we're taking it by force if necessary. We are getting our hands on the tools to explore our own godhood, and it's really cool to kind of be a part of that, and with something like this anthology. In short, we're not looking at printing any more copies of the book one of the Anthology of Sorcery, but we are already putting together everything for the next edition, which we're hoping on having out about the same time next year.
Excellent. Well, you know, who knows? Down the road, maybe you'll put out a box set of several volumes of this anthology, you know? I mean, that's always a possibility if there's a demand, right?
Absolutely. I mean, once again, as a black magician, I don't take anything off the table. So,
and that I think that would be really, from my perspective, that would be keeping with your word as far as it would be a completely different circumstance. But again, like you said, you don't take, you're open to all potentials. I want to thank you again, becomealivinggod.com, E.A. Coetting. We are looking forward to hearing more from you and your camp. Timothy Donahue, that's your partner as well in this whole endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
He also wrote an introduction to the anthology. And once again, I hope you have great fortune in the future and a great summer.
Well, thank you, and to you as well. And I look forward to hopefully speaking to you at some point in the future as well.
Oh, absolutely. We should definitely keep in touch and have you come back on with all the new and exciting developments that I'm sure will be coming up for you in the future. And everyone will be staying tuned to hear all the new developments from EA Co-Edding. And once again, farewell, everybody. Thank you for listening. And look forward to next week with Professor James Fetzer talking about conspiracy sciences. It's going to be an exciting show. So thanks again, everybody. And thanks again to Mater X for watching the kids while we made this amazing conversation happen with EA Co-Edding. And have a great weekend, everybody.